Good evening. Welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Lisa Krieger. I'm science and medical research reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Matt Walker tonight. Dr. Walker is an expert in sleep research and its impact in memory, learning, and brain plasticity. He's director and principal investigator of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab, and he's professor in the Department of Psychology there. Prior to joining UC Berkeley, he was a sleep researcher, an instructor of psychiatry, and an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. For his research and academic contributions, Dr. Walker has been recognized by Harvard University, as well as the National Academy of Sciences. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Matt Walker.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks. Good evening. Can you all hear me in the, I was going to say cheap seats at the back, I won't say that. Can you hear me in the seats at the back? You can? Very good. So it's a true pleasure and a delight to be speaking to you this evening. I'd like to start with a somewhat standard disclaimer, if you don't mind. I think it's safe to say that when most speakers look to their audience and see people who are falling asleep or nodding off, it can be profoundly disheartening. However, based on the topic of tonight's discussion and presentation, I'm almost going to actively encourage that kind of behavior from you. Okay. Indeed, knowing what I know particularly about the relationship between sleep and memory, it's actually the greatest form of flattery for me to see people like you not being able to resist the urge to strengthen and solidify what I'm telling you by falling asleep. So feel free just to sort of ebb and flow in and out of consciousness throughout the entire talk. I'll take absolutely no offense. And the talk for the first 30 minutes or so is really going to come in four main acts, so to speak. Firstly, I just want to begin by telling you a little bit about what sleep is and its different types and what emerges from sleep. And then I'll tell you about the different functions that we're starting to find that sleep supports, and functions plural. That's the important take home. We don't just sleep for one reason. There's many reasons that we sleep. I'll speak about the reasons for the brain, but you should also be aware that there are functions that sleep provides downstairs in the body. In terms of the brain, I'll tell you about the role of sleep in preparing your brain for efficient learning, and then after learning, for essentially grabbing hold of those memories and hitting the save button and cementing them into the architecture of your brain. Then I'll tell you some new emerging evidence that sleep can go beyond simply putting memories, individual memories, into long-term memory. Sleep can actually take pieces of information and intelligently cross-link them to come up with next day novel creative insights. And then finally, we'll move away from learning and memory and creativity, and I'll finish up with a role for sleep in regulating our emotional well-being and the emotional circuits of the brain, preparing us for next day social and emotional challenges. So that's the basic overview. Let me start by telling you what sleep is. And I just love this picture of this wonderful large cat here. Sleep. You can just sense the depth of sleep, can't you? If we're going for this sort of savanna animal opening, have you ever, firstly, giraffe, what a bizarre anatomical object to begin with. Secondly, have you ever considered how something like that, a giraffe, sleeps? I hadn't until I got into this research. Would you like to know how a giraffe sleeps? That's how it sleeps. Isn't that remarkable, the contortion to get into that? And it tells us at least two important things. Firstly, that despite such a bizarre anatomy, sleep will still find a way to be obtained by the brain. And secondly, not just in giraffes, but in every species that we've studied so far, we can observe sleep or something that looks very much like sleep. What that means is that sleep has fought its way through vehemently every step along the evolutionary pathway. And if that's true, sleep must be essential at the most basic of biological levels. And that's exactly what we're starting to find. So in terms of what sleep is, as many of you may know, sleep, at least in mammalian species, has been broadly classified into two main types. On the one hand, we have non-rapid eye movement sleep, or non-REM sleep for short, and that's been further subdivided into four separate stages, which are unimaginatively named stages 1 through 4. We're a creative bunch, sleep researchers, increasing in the depth of sleep. So stages 3 and 4 are those really deep stages of dreamless sleep, what we commonly think of as restorative sleep. Whilst on the other hand, we have rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep, which is named not after the popular Michael Stipe pop band, but because of these bizarre horizontal shuttling eye movements that occur during this stage of sleep. And we don't fully understand why. And it's strange because these muscles that control your eyes, they're called the extraocular muscles, they are the only muscles that are spurred from something else that happens during REM sleep, which is that the entirety of the rest of your body is paralyzed. All of your voluntary skeletal muscles are inhibited during REM sleep. Why is that? It turns out the reason is because it's this stage of sleep from which we principally dream. And so your brain paralyzes your body so your mind can go on this wonderful journey of dreaming. And that's a point to note, that dreaming from REM sleep really is a case in some ways of how your brain goes completely out of its mind. In fact, everyone here, so long as you slept last night, and I hope you did, you all became flagrantly psychotic. Now, before you reject my diagnosis of that sort of nightly psychosis, let me give you 5 good reasons as to why that it's accurate. Firstly, when you went into REM sleep and you were dreaming, you started to see things which were not there. So you were hallucinating. Secondly, you believed things that could not possibly be true. So you were delusional. Third, you became confused about time, place, and person. So you were suffering from disorientation. Fourth, you had these wildly fluctuating emotions, something that psychiatrists call being affectively labile. And then how wonderful, you woke up this morning and you forgot most, if not all, of that dream experience. So you're suffering from amnesia. If you were to experience any one of those 5 symptoms whilst you're awake, you would likely be seeking psychological treatment. But for reasons, again, that we don't fully understand, it seems to be both a normal biological and psychological process. So now we've understood a little bit about sleep as an entity. What does it do? And the answer is many things for the brain. Firstly, let me tell you about the critical need for sleep before learning to prepare your brain almost like a dry sponge, ready to soak up new information, to learn effectively. So essentially in this experiment, and I'm now going to walk you through a series of scientific experiments for the rest of the talk so we can get into the data and see if we believe it. Essentially here we're going to examine whether you can pull the all-nighter like many students do, and still be learning effectively. Here's how you do the experiment. You take 2 groups of participants, a sleep group and a sleep deprivation group. Both of them are awake across the first day, but then across the following night, those in the deprivation group here in red, we keep them awake in the laboratory under full supervision, and that whilst those in the sleep group, they get a full 8-hour night of sleep opportunity. Both are awake across the second day, and at the end of that second day, we're going to have them perform a learning task where we're going to try and teach them a whole series of new facts to see how well they can cram that information into the brain. And then we're going to test them to see how efficient that learning has been. But instead of testing them immediately after learning, we actually wait until 2 full recovery nights of sleep before we test them, so that any measure of memory that we get is not confounded by them simply being too sleepy or not alert enough to recall what they were able to learn. And that's what you're looking at here on the vertical axis, the efficiency of their learning. So the higher up you are, the better you are. And if you just put these two groups head to head, what you find is that under conditions of sleep deprivation, there is a quite profound 40% deficit in the capacity of the human brain to make new memories, to record new fact-based experiences, which should be a little concerning considering what we know is happening to sleep in our educational populations, by the way. Just to put this in context for any students out there, it's simply the difference between acing an exam and failing it miserably, okay? Now, of course, in terms of these data, this is just sort of performance. We don't truly know what's going on in the brain here, what's failing to produce these memory impairments. So we've been able to repeat those types of experiments, but now subjects are actually inside an MRI scanner during that learning session. And so we can take snapshots of brain activity as they're attempting to learn. So we get these patterns of brain activity during learning in those people who've had a good night of sleep, and then patterns of learning activity in those people who are sleep deprived. And then we're simply going to subtract one from the other to see if there's any difference. And when you do that subtraction, when you do that comparison, what you find is that there is a highly selective but highly significant deficit and impairment in this structure that I'm circling here. It's a structure called the hippocampus. And just for those of you who are not familiar with looking at MRI images, and presumably most people, this is as if we've sliced from ear to ear and you're looking into the brain from the front. So this is the top of the brain, the base of the brain, left and right side. And these areas that I'm circling here, these are the hippocampus. You've got one on the left and one on the right. And these cool blue blobs demonstrate that there was significant impairment in that area, in those people who were sleep deprived, compared to a nice strong signal in those people who'd had a good night of sleep during learning. Why is this important? Well, it turns out that this structure, the hippocampus, is the quintessential reservoir within your brain where you create and form new fact-based memories. In fact, if you want to know what life is like without the hippocampus, I would urge you to watch this movie, Memento. How many people have seen this movie? Okay, good number of people. For those of you who haven't, I urge you to watch it. It's a great movie. I won't spoil the punchline, but essentially this gentleman has an accident which damages his brain. And from that point forward, he can no longer make any new memories. He is densely amnesic. It is exactly this structure that he damages in the movie, the hippocampus, preventing him from making new memories. And it is the very same structure that sleep deprivation will attack and prevent your brain from being able to lay down those new pieces of information. Now, coming back to the data again, I described the bad things that happen when you don't get sleep. But let's turn the coin over and let's ask about the other side of that equation. When you do get sleep, what is it about that sleep that seems to promote the restoration of your learning from one night to the next morning? And we've actually examined this too, and what we found is that there seems to be specific electrical bursts of brainwave activity that are occurring during the night that seem to promote the restoration of memory. And it's these little delightful chaps. These are called sleep spindles. So what you're looking at here is one channel of brainwave activity that we're recording from the head during sleep. And these short bursts of electrical activity, they last for about 1 second, and they come from non-rapid eye movement sleep. And we describe them as sleep spindles, these sort of champagne cork bursts of electrical activity. And they've been proposed as a mechanism to allow you to take information that you've got stored in that structure, the hippocampus, and think of the hippocampus like a USB stick. Okay, it's very good at grabbing information very quickly, but it has a limited storage capacity. And at night, we believe that these sleep spindle events are helping transfer, almost like a ski lift, the information from the USB stick in the hippocampus up to the cortex, which is the hard drive, the large storage capacity of the brain. And essentially, by moving information, translocating it, sort of shifting that real estate burden of information from the USB hippocampus up to the cortex hard drive, when you wake up the next day, not only are those things that you learned now secure and transferred to the cortex, the hard drive, you've also cleared out the sort of storage capacity of the USB stick, so you can start to learn effectively all over again the next day. And in fact, that's exactly what we find. that if you look at how many of these sleep spindles people are having at night, it accurately predicts the degree of their restoration from one morning to the next. So here, if we just look at the number of spindles and how they're correlating with the restoration of your learning before versus after sleep, and that's what these hot colors demonstrate. So you can see that the more of these strange sleep spindle events that you're having over the front of the brain, they accurately predict how much better your learning capacity is going to be when you wake up. And that's what you're seeing in this correlation plot here. The more sleep spindles that you have at night, the greater the degree of memory restoration that you develop when you wake up compared to before sleep. So we can start to understand both sides of the coin now, not just the bad things that happen when you take sleep away, but the benefit and exactly what is giving that benefit of sleep when it does occur itself. So that was a role for sleep before learning. It turns out that you also need sleep after learning. And sleep after learning is not just good for taking pieces of information that you've learned and essentially hitting the save button and preventing them from being forgotten long term. And there's good evidence for that now, and it seems to depend on deep non-REM sleep, stages 3 and 4. What we've also started to find is that sleep can do much more than that. Sleep seems to be able to synthesize new pieces of information together, and by doing so, give you insights and creative knowledge. Or actually, I should really say, it takes knowledge and transfers it essentially into wisdom, which is knowing what that information all means when you fit it together. Let me give you an empirical scientific example of this sort of sleep-inspired creativity. So in this study, they're going to do something called the numeric number reduction task, okay? It is one of those tests that psychologists love to administer and participants hate to perform. Okay, here's how it goes. I'm going to show you lots and lots, hundreds of these strings of numbers. And you have to work through these number problems to finally come up with an end solution. And one way that you can solve these problems is using a set of rules that I give you. So here's how it essentially works. Firstly, what you can see is from this string of numbers that there is actually only three types of numbers in this string: 1, 4, or 9. And starting on the left side of this row of numbers, you're going to start working through according to these rules. And here's the first of the two rules. You're going to start here and you're going to compare the first number to the next number. If the next number in the row is the same as the number that came before it, I want you to write down the very same number. Is that true here? Yes, it is. It's a 1 followed by a 1. It's the same number after the previous one. So write down the same number, a 1. The second rule comes into play now. Take this number and compare it to the next number above it. Is it the same or is it different? Well, here we've got a 1 and the next one in line is a 4, so it's a different number. The second rule is that if it's a different number, write down the only other remaining number out of the three that are in this problem. So we write down a number 9. Let's do that again, according to those two rules. We've got a 9. Let's compare it to the next one. Is it the same or different? If it's the same, write down the same number. Well, it's not. It's different. We've got a 9. Let's compare it to a 4. Different number. Write down the only other remaining number of those three, which is a 1. 1 to a 9, it's different. Write down a 4. 4 to a 4, it's the same. So write down the same number of 4. 4 to a 9, it's a 1. 1 to a 4, and you finally get the end answer, which is 9. Painfully boring, okay? Some people, I suspect there's a danger of people losing the will to live when they do these types of problems, but you get the idea. Now, if you were careful and listening to me, and this is how they describe it in the experiment, you'll notice that I said, one way to solve this problem is by using those rules, because it turns out there's another way. There is a hidden shortcut embedded in these problems, and it's common across all of these problems. In other words, there's a cheat. And if you figure out what the hidden cheat is, you can blow through these problems far more quickly. Here's the cheat. It turns out that no matter what string of numbers you get, and as I said, you do hundreds of them, the second number that you produce is always the final answer. So all you have to do is work up to the problem to this point, and then you can forget the rest and just write down the answer. if you've clued in to the hidden rule. And so here's what they're going to do. They're going to expose a bunch of participants to these problems. And then they're going to bring you back 12 hours later and then see if by repeating some more problems, you've developed that hidden insight. In other words, you've sort of come back with the light bulb switched on. Now, for half of those participants, that 12-hour period spanned a day of being awake. So you're exposed to the problems in the morning, you come back 12 hours later in the evening, you perform it again. The other half of the participants, that 12-hour period spanned a full 8-hour night of sleep. So they're exposed to the problems in the evening, and then they are re-performing the test the next morning. So the brain has had exactly the same amount of time to be working on the problem, as it were. It's just that in one of those conditions, they've had sleep in addition. The other, they've remained awake. And so what we're going to look at here is the proportion or the percent of those participants in each of those two groups who develop insight into the hidden rule when they come back after that 12-hour delay. And so that's what you're looking at here on the vertical axis, the proportion of those participants who've got the insight when they come back. What about the group that remained awake on the problem? Well, less than 25% of them came back and developed that hidden insight, that creative knowledge. What about the sleep group? Were they worse? Were they the same? Or were they better? And they were better, but the surprising thing was by how much better they were. This is the sleep group. The sleep group, almost 60% compared to less than 25% of these participants developed this creative sleep-inspired insight the next morning. It's quite remarkable. And what we've been finding is that these types of creative solution sort of advances that happen at night during sleep often depend, not always, but often depend on rapid eye movement sleep, dreaming sleep. And by the way, just as a quick aside, I want to tell you about a creative genius who, when I give these types of data, people will often come up to me afterwards and say, well, hang on a second, I heard that he didn't sleep very much. And it was this gentleman here. Does anybody know who this is? And the apparatus probably gives it away. Edison, Thomas Edison, who parenthetically has probably a lot to answer for in terms of our bad sleep based on some of his inventions. But apparently he was notoriously a short sleeper at night. He didn't sleep very much. And now, of course, we don't have any empirical proof that that was the case. But even if it's true that he didn't sleep as much as most people would be recommended to at night, it turns out that he was a habitual napper during the day. And here's some. Here he is after a garden party, which looks like a pretty good garden party by how horizontal and out he is on the grass there. Here he is on his inventor's bench in his studio, sleeping on the bench itself, pillow under head. In fact, not only did he enjoy naps, he understood the creative power that came from naps and developed a technique to use it. Here's how it worked. This is just, guy was a genius. He would sit in his armchair like this here in this picture. And then he would, with a chair that had these armrests, he would take some steel ball bearings in one hand, turn his hand so the palm was facing up to the ceiling, and then rest the back of his arm down on the armrest. And then he would take this metal saucepan like this and place it underneath the armrest of the chair upside down. He would place a pad of paper and a pen next to him on his desk, and then he would gradually relax back and start to fall asleep. And so he didn't get too far into sleep. What would happen is that as the muscle tone relaxed, he would release the steel ball bearings. They would crash on the saucepan, wake him up, and then he would write down all of the ideas that he was having during sleep. Isn't that brilliant? Genius, absolutely genius. So no wonder nobody ever tells you you should stay awake on a problem. Instead, what do they tell you? Always sleep on a problem. And in fact, I've been told that in almost all languages, there is this same type of phraseology. What that means is that this effect transcends cultural boundaries. I should note, by the way, that I was also informed, the British, we say you sleep on a problem. The French apparently say that it translates to you sleep with a problem. British, you sleep on a problem. I think that says so much about the difference between the British and the French. We're such a bloody unromantic bunch. Anyway, crashing on, this is not about England or France. Anyway, that was sleep and creativity. Let me now finish up with sleep and emotional health and emotional well-being, because there is an intimate association here. And I think many of us have a sense that these two factors of sleep and emotion do interact in some meaningful kind of way. It's that idea of a parent holding a child, and the child is crying, and they look at you and they say, well, he or she, they just didn't sleep well last night. As if there's some universal parental knowledge that bad sleep the night before equals bad mood and emotion reactivity the next day. And in fact, clinical evidence argues in favor of this relationship. Almost all psychiatric mood disorders display co-occurring abnormalities of sleep. In fact, it's almost impossible to find any psychiatric mood disorder that doesn't display problems with sleep. So prominent are they often that they form part of the diagnostic criteria to receive that label of that psychiatric disorder. So despite that suggested interplay, we actually haven't understood a lot about the brain dynamics that are going on here, and that's something else that we've been interested in. Now, when you think you've got two factors that are interrelated, one way to test that interaction is by manipulating one of those factors and then observing what happens to the other. And so here we're going to manipulate the factor of sleep and block it with total deprivation and see if, as a consequence, we can trigger an amplified emotional reaction from the brain. So very similar design to one I described to you previously. Control group, that's going to get a good night of sleep. Deprivation group, we take sleep away, monitored, across that night. And then at the end of that second day, now we're going to wedge them inside the MRI scanner and perform an emotional challenge task with them. And here during this task, they're going to see a series of standardized psychological picture slides that range in a gradient from being emotionally neutral to increasingly negative and unpleasant. And I'll just show you some examples of these types of images. They get a lot worse. They get pretty gruesome, and there'd be sort of reactive vomiting in the front row, so I won't show you them. But you get the idea here. So what we can do, we can ask a very simple question. What in the brain shows increasing reactivity to increasing emotional negativity? And the structure that we were focusing on here is this structure that I'm showing you in red. It's a structure buried deep in the middle of the brain, and it's called the amygdala. And again, you have one on the left side and one on the right side. And it seems to be one of the centerpieces of emotional reactivity in the brain, particularly negative emotional reactivity. And so if you look in this area of the brain in those people who've had a good night of sleep, you do see a modest degree of a reaction here. And this is what we would expect. So again, this is a very similar view to one I described before, where you're sort of looking into the brain from the front. So here's the top and the bottom and left and right side. And I'm circling here the amygdala for you. And you can see these little hot spots demonstrate that after a good night of sleep, you did have a reaction in that part of the brain. As I said, that's what you would expect. When you look at the sleep deprivation group, however, rather than seeing impaired brain activity, which is the story that we found with learning and memory, when it comes to emotion, you see exactly the opposite. In fact, the emotional brain here was more than 60% increased in its reactivity, this amplified emotional reaction without sleep. That's a dramatic elevation physiologically relative to normative levels. And I can just focus in here and you can see that difference more clearly. Perhaps the more interesting question, though, was why? Why was your emotional brain so disturbed, so amplified without sleep? And through some additional analyses, what we found was that in those people who'd had a full night of sleep, this region here in green, and just to orient you, this is a slightly different view of the brain now. It's as if, which way are we looking? It's as if we've sliced from the back of the head to the front of the head. I've removed one half of the brain, and you're looking in from the front. So this area in green is an area that we call the frontal cortex and the middle part of the frontal cortex. And what we found is that in those people who'd had good sleep, this part of the brain was strongly connected to this deep emotional center, the amygdala, and regulating its belief with inhibition. So in other words, with a night of sleep, this frontal area, which you can think of like the CEO of the brain, it's very good at sort of making rational, logical, controlled decisions, it was just reining in your sort of emotional brain. So in other words, with sleep, you've got this nice balanced mix between the emotional gas pedal and the brake, okay, the frontal cortex and the emotional amygdala. Without sleep, however, unfortunately, what we found was that that connection had been severed. And as a consequence, you've got this amplified, almost Neanderthal-like reaction from the deep emotional brain structures. So in other words, when you take sleep away, as a consequence, the brain produces this imbalance of sort of all gas pedal and no brake, sort of too little frontal lobe control and excessive emotional reactivity. Now, I could go on and show you some more bar graphs and some MRI images to perhaps illustrate the effects, but I'm actually going to finish up by letting a sleep-deprived subject do that for me, because it turns out that we actually do video diaries with our sleep-deprived participants throughout the evening and throughout the night. And you're going to meet one of our participants under the pseudonym of John Fang. John has just entered the study. It's 11:30 at night on day one. John has been awake for a perfectly normal 16 hours. And let's hear from John what his sort of hopes and aspirations are for the deprivation period. And hopefully you'll be able to hear this.
Hello, my name is John Fang. I'm a junior at Harvard. It's about 11:27 right now. I've been here for about an hour. So it's the first hour. I'm writing my paper right now, 30-page paper. Hopefully I can get some of it done before I get too sleepy.
So that's John, perfectly likable, affable chap who's hoping to get his 30-page report complete in a night of sleep deprivation. It's classical delusional undergraduate thinking, I have to say. See it all the time. Now, let's now fast forward the clock. It's now 5:30 the following morning. John has now been awake for 22 hours straight, and instantly you'll notice one of the hallmark features of sleep deprivation, which is that you actually slide down in your chair. John is down about 5 inches here now. It's about an inch for every hour that you're awake beyond 16, we've calculated. And so let's hear from John how that 30-page report has been going, and just notice how emotionally different John has become. Some people have described him as becoming a little bit emotionally unhinged. So let's see how he's been getting on. And I apologize ahead of time for the profanity. So did you notice how John went from being remarkably upset and annoyed that he'd got none of his 30-page report complete to then finding it almost hilarious? And he's almost sort of punched, drunk, giddy on sleep deprivation and then came right back down to baseline again. That is a remarkably abnormal emotional distance to travel within such a short time period. And I think, again, emphasizes this emotional lability that the brain suffers without sufficient sleep and this restoration that a night of sleep normally provides. So I'll finish up here, and in terms of why we sleep, I think we're finding that we sleep for a whole constellation, as I said, of different reasons, emotional regulation, learning, memory, even creativity. And so if there's one piece of mental furniture that I sort of could dispose on you as you walk away from this evening, it would simply be that the most effective thing you can do each and every day to reset your brain and also body health, and I hope we can speak about that in questions, is a good night of sleep. And hopefully it's not that difficult that we just lie our heads on our pillows and off we go. So I should finish by thanking all of my lab members, by the way. I actually don't do any hard work. I just drink tea, I write emails, they do all of the hard work, and then I come and give talks like this and pretend that their data is my own. It's not at all, it's all of theirs, and I'm immensely grateful for their hard work. And finally, I noticed some people in the audience stayed awake during the entire talk, so tonight, after all of this information, I hope you sleep well. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Dr. Walker. Fascinating research. Fascinating research. So we have a bunch of questions here, which is great, but I'm going to start with a few of mine, if we can. First, tell us about John. Did he go back? Can you catch up on your sleep on weekends? Once he went back to his dorm room, then what happened?
Yes, so there is this odd notion, and I think it's particularly prevalent in students, but you see it across a large swath of the population. And it's something that I've myself and other colleagues have described as almost sleep bulimia, which is that during the week, people think that they can sort of cut short their sleep. And then when it comes to the weekend, you can just binge on sleep and get back what you lost. And that's not true in terms of things like learning and memory. We can take you, we can teach you information, and then I can deprive you of sleep the following night. And then I'm not going to test you the following day. I'm going to wait until you've had, let's say, one more night or even two more nights of recovery, and then I'll test you to see if the brain has been able to at least grab a hold of those memories in that recovery sleep. And unfortunately, that's not the case. That, in fact, you fail to consolidate those memories, even with recovery sleep. And what that tells us is that if you don't sleep within the first 24 hours after learning, you lose the chance to hit the save button on those memories. And so conceptually, sleep is not like the bank. Okay, you can't accumulate a debt and then hope to pay it off at this later point in time, sort of like the weekend binging. It seems to be an all or nothing event. So if you don't snooze, you lose.
You can't really train yourself to get by with less sleep either, can you, if you're undergrad or going through medical school?
No, that's another common misnomer that, firstly, the human or humans in generally are one of the few species that will deliberately deprive themselves of sleep. And what that means is that evolution has never had to face the challenge of developing coping mechanisms against insufficient sleep. There is no safety net in place because it's never faced that challenge. And so this misnomer that you'll get, particularly in certain professions, for example, medical, I often see that, you know, well, I can just train myself to overcome sleep. You know, I'll just give myself a couple of years and I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, to think that you could go against thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution and quickly within, you know, just a few years overcome this biological necessity is an unfortunate misnomer. And it's probably amplified, worse so, by your subjective insight into how you're doing without sleep is a miserable predictor of objectively how you actually are doing without sleep. And so it's that idea of people saying, no, I survive completely fine on 6 hours of sleep. And we would say, well, no, we know that you think you survive fine on 6 hours of sleep, but it's very easy to demonstrate impairments with that insufficient sleep. So it's like the, you know, it's been said before, it's like the drunk driver thinking that they're perfectly fine to get in the car.
We have a question here, which is a good one, particularly because you gave the example of Edison. Can naps help? Can they make up for inadequate sleep at night?
Yeah, so good question. In fact, there's two embedded questions there. Is one, are naps effective and do they give any measurable benefit? And secondly, can they almost be used sort of prophylactically to self-medicate insufficient sleep? The answer to the first question is yes, that we can give naps during the day, and those naps up to 60 minutes, 90 minutes, they do seem to give benefits for things like learning, memory, emotional regulation. We can see that. We haven't throttled them back sufficiently to, say, the sort of common 10-minute power nap that many people are familiar with to see if that short amount of sleep gives a measurable benefit. But certainly naps, as I said, around the hour will give that benefit. In terms of whether naps can be useful to give back sleep if you're in that or facing the circumstance of insufficient sleep, it's not a bad thing to do if you really haven't had a good night of sleep beforehand. You have to be a little bit careful with naps, though. If you take them too late in the day, what will happen is that it will cause you difficulties in getting to sleep at night, and here's why. As you're awake across the day, a pressure builds up in your brain, and it's a chemical pressure. There's a chemical that builds up, and that chemical will gradually develop a need for your brain to sleep, and that's why ultimately at the end of the day you start to feel tired because this chemical is built up to sufficient amounts. If you nap, essentially it's like releasing the pressure valve on a steam cooker, and you release some of that pressure to sleep. And so if you nap too late in the day, when you wake up from the nap, you won't have long enough between then and when you want to get to sleep in the evening to generate enough pressure once more to fall asleep. And so you start to get difficulties in trying to get to sleep if you're napping too late. So you have to be careful. It's a potential double-edged sword.
Do we know why people need different amounts of sleep? We're a sleep-deprived culture, and there's a fair amount of pride in getting by with little. And those people who don't need much, I think we envy them.
And it turns out that those people who don't need much are a far smaller section of society than many of us think, or many of us would wish, because the vast majority of people can't survive on the amount of sleep that they're currently getting. There are a few genetic oddities in society, but it's a small proportion of 0.0000% who have a genetic composition that means that they can get away with just a handful of hours of sleep a night. And so it seems to be some of that difference is genetic variability in the extreme. But there is certainly just variability around that sweet spot of about 8 hours. Some people, you know, may need 8.5, 9. Some people seem to get away with 7 and feel still okay. After 6, you can see observable impairments. And I think that's just simple variability. It's the same with calories. You know, you could say, well, what is the stock standard amount that we should be eating? And we could say 2,000 calories is a good bet for the average human being. But depending on everyone's unique physiology, some people will require less calorie intake, some people more, and it seems to be the same with sleep too. And even within an individual, it varies from one day to the next based on what you're doing too.
And does that change as we age? Do our sleep patterns change, or do we need less sleep as we age?
Yeah, so two great questions there. How does sleep change with age? And if we're getting less sleep as we get older, which we do, does that mean that we don't need that sleep? Sleep does change as we get older. It's perhaps one of the most prominent physiological hallmarks of getting old. One of the most dramatic reductions is the amount of deep sleep that we're getting, stages 3 and 4 of deep non-REM sleep. That starts to deteriorate actually quite early in life. Even by your early 30s, you can start to see the reduction, and it gets perniciously reduced as we get into older age. And we believe that that's not simply indicative of us needing less sleep. It seems to be because the brain is deteriorating as we get older, and the parts that generate that deep sleep unfortunately deteriorate most rapidly, and therefore we just can't generate that deep sleep that we need despite still needing it. And that seems to actually lead to issues of memory problems, that common idea of sort of forgetfulness as we get older. We're now starting to find that those two things, cognitive impairment, sleep disruption as we get older, are not just co-occurring, they're actually interrelated.
Why are some people morning people and others late night owls? We have some good questions about those of us who jump out of bed, you know, bright and cheerful in the morning, and for others it's pretty hard, which leads to the next question of the role of coffee.
Indeed. So I'll take both of those. So it turns out that these differences in the sleep field, we actually call them owls and larks because of being morning and evening types. And that now we understand is genetically predisposed. Some people just like being awake late into the night and like sleeping late into the morning. Others vice versa. So it seems to be genetic. The way that caffeine works comes back to that idea of sleep pressure that I described. And I told you that there's a chemical that builds up in the brain the longer that you're awake. That chemical is called adenosine. What you drink in coffee is the active ingredient that gives you the benefit is caffeine. What caffeine does is it gets into the brain and it jumps onto the receptors that adenosine normally binds to. And so now your brain is fooled into thinking that there isn't as much of this adenosine built up as there actually is. So now your brain thinks, oh, I'm not as sleepy anymore because I'm not getting that signal of being awake for so long or that signal of sleepiness. But what the problem there, and particularly when you're drinking caffeine late into the night, is that adenosine, that building up of sleep pressure, doesn't stop. It continues to build. So when the caffeine is washed out of your system, now you crash, because as it washes out, now you've got this huge mass of buildup of adenosine waiting to weigh your brain down. And that's why you need, and that's where the espresso comes in. Not that I'm advocating any of it.
Which leads to the question of sleep aids. For the melatonin is talked about as being popular, certainly Ambien, Lunesta. How do they work? And do they work?
Yes, so melatonin is a naturally released hormone in the brain, and it's released in this sort of biological, rhythmic way. And melatonin normally is released at nighttime. It's actually called the hormone of darkness, which sounds very vampire-esque, but it's not. The melatonin essentially is telling your brain it's nighttime. And so it's a very good trigger to help you instigate sleep, or tell you when sleep should be happening. And that's how it works. That's why it's useful for jet lag. When you're in a new time zone, now during the day, because you've sort of flown, let's say, 11 or 12 hours into the future, now during the day, it's your habitual nighttime, and your brain is releasing melatonin. That's why you feel sleepy during the day, because your brain is being shouted at by melatonin. It's nighttime. And then when it comes to your nighttime in the new time zone, now melatonin is not being released. So you don't feel sleepy, you don't feel tired, whereas everyone else who's been in that time zone for a long time, they're having a nice spike in melatonin. And that's why melatonin can be useful when you are traveling in different time zones. Take it at night in the new time zone, and that helps fool your brain into thinking it's nighttime all over again. Ambien and Lunesta, these are sleep medications. These are newer sleep medications. They're slightly different to the older medications. The older medications were called sedative hypnotics. And essentially what they would do is just knock you out. You wouldn't be awake with those older medications, but it was very difficult physiologically to argue that you were in natural sleep. These newer medications like Ambien and Lunesta, they work in a slightly different way. They still work on the same neurochemical system as those old medications, but they do so, they tickle it in a slightly different way. And they can produce something that it may be more naturalistic in sleep, but there's a caveat here, and that caveat is that those medications can keep you out of having as much of that deep non-REM sleep that we described. And it's that type of sleep, for example, that's very useful for helping you cement those new fact-based memories, to consolidate memories. And so it's troubling that these sleep medications, by way of keeping you out of having as much of that deep sleep, they may prevent those types of learning and memory benefits. And there's some work now that's been published that those types of medications, despite giving you sleep, not only do they accelerate these brain plastic mechanisms that support learning and memory, they actually seem to inhibit them. And that's a concern, considering the number of millions of people that are on these medications, and especially as those, the prescription age of those medications starts to come down, that's an especially concerning issue.
Do you have any strategies for going to sleep naturally?
Yes, so there's lots of non-pharmacological things that you can do. Exercise seems to be a good thing to help regulate your biological rhythms and help regulate your sleep. Going to bed and waking up at a standard time, that's very helpful, particularly a standard wake-up time. That's very good at reinforcing the biological rhythms and helping you keep a regular sleep-wake schedule. And then obviously throttling back from caffeine 7 to 8 hours before you try to get to sleep, that's very beneficial. Staying away from alcohol. Some people think of alcohol as a sedative, and it is, and they find that it helps them get off to sleep. The problem, and that may be true by sedating your brain, the problem is that it does two additional things later in the night. Firstly, it fragments your sleep, so you wake up far more frequently throughout the night. Furthermore, alcohol is a very good suppressor of REM sleep, and so it takes away that dream sleep that we also know is important for things like creativity, emotional regulation. So staying away from some stuff and going towards other stuff, it's a very good scientific recommendation, is beneficial to produce non-pharmacologically good sleep.
And for coping with jet lag, do you recommend melatonin?
Yes, so melatonin can be useful, and it's been demonstrated to be efficacious. One of the challenging things here in the United States is that it's not regulated by the FDA, so you can go and buy it from the health food store. And that sometimes means that it's tricky to know that you're actually getting active and the same dose of melatonin each and every time.
great question here. If you don't sleep for a long amount of time, will you eventually drop down unconscious? Does lack of sleep kill people, or do you only wish you could die?
So it's not only that you drop down unconscious, but you die. I know that sounds striking, but there's two pieces of evidence that tell us that you will die without sufficient sleep. Firstly, it was a study done back in the 1980s, and now ethically it may be debatable whether or not it will ever be repeated. They sleep-deprived rats, and what they found is that after about 9 to 11 days of sleep deprivation, those rats died. What that means is that rats will die as quickly of sleep deprivation as they will of food deprivation. Secondly, there is a human analog. Now, don't worry, scientists didn't take human beings and sleep-deprive them until death, but unfortunately, there is a medical condition. It's a very rare genetically inherited disorder called fatal familial insomnia. And as the title suggests, it sort of gives away the end of the story, as it were. And these people have a genetic mutation that prevents them from sleeping, and it's a gradual deterioration of their sleep. And so over a 6 months to 1 year period, gradually they'll develop insomnia. They will go into almost like a dementia state. Then they will become catatonic. And after about, as I said, 6 to 12 months of no sleep, they will die. And it's the best evidence, it's profoundly unfortunate evidence, but it's the best scientific evidence that we have that in humans too, insufficient sleep will kill you. We also know that there's very strong relationships between insufficient sleep and morbidity and mortality as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think fatality during driving, people falling asleep, is a major public health concern. Talk about the micro sleeping that I think we probably all experience, where you're driving, your eyes are awake, but you've discovered you've fallen asleep for a few minutes. What's going on there?
Yes, yeah, so we are now understanding that these things called microsleeps happen when you're fatigued and when you're sleep deprived. And Dr. David Dinges at the University of Pennsylvania has done some wonderful work on this, demonstrating that you start to have these lapses in attention. It seems to be that the brain gets very quickly consumed, almost into a sleep-like state, when you haven't been sleeping well. And the danger here is manyfold. Perhaps most dramatic is driving. And so if you're driving along the freeway 40, 50 miles an hour, and you have one of these microsleeps which happen for about a second, 2 seconds, at that speed, that will be all the time that it takes you to go from one lane to the next. And so that may be the last microsleep that you ever have. In fact, what we now understand is that 1 in 5 road traffic accidents seem to be caused by fatigue. And so it's a major issue. It's not just in concerns for driving. Think about professions where sleep deprivation is rife. We've already spoken about the medical profession. There were surveys done in residents where they pull these huge shifts with insufficient sleep. And what you find is that medical residents will admit to 1 in 5 serious medical errors have occurred by way of fatigue and sleepiness. In fact, 1 in 20 deaths have been caused by their fatigue and their inattentiveness. And what's remarkable is that when these residents finish these heroic shifts, what do you think they want to do? They want to go home and sleep. And to get home, they drive. And it turns out that they have a significantly elevated risk of then getting in a road traffic accident. And the risk isn't just small. It's not just a 15%, 20%, it's not even 50%. Their elevated risk is 168% increase. And so it's just ironic to me, you know, it's baffling that, you know, you could have the resident who's been working in the accident and emergency center all night, then gets in their car only to then cause an accident, be brought back into accident and emergency. You know, it's just, so we need to, and it's pun intended, wake up to the essential importance of sleep in these professions.
Thank you. Important message. Is it possible to get too much sleep? Does it lead to sluggishness?
So this is it's a great question, and it's an area that has been defined as hypersomnia, which means too much sleep. And it occurs both in people who have depression. There's been suggestions that they have hypersomnia. It's actually tricky. We don't fully understand this feature yet. It could be that what they're reporting is simply spending a lot more time in bed, and not all of that time is spent asleep. So it's not true hypersomnia. It's just staying in bed a lot longer. But there may be that, too, in those mood disorders. We don't fully understand. But I think more generally, many of us have had this sense or experience of setting the alarm, but unfortunately we didn't set it correctly, and we oversleep. And we almost have this sleep hangover where you've just gone beyond your naturalistic sweet spot. And for the rest of the day, you just kind of feel cloudy and groggy. And that's reported far too frequently amongst people, I believe, to be just anecdotal. I think there's probably some legitimacy to that. So just like it's bad to have too much wakefulness, it also is perhaps bad to have too much sleep. There's a balance there. It's about one third of our life asleep and two thirds awake. And when you go beyond any of those metrics within either wake or sleep, it's perhaps not optimal.
Thank you. This is Silicon Valley, so people are asking about devices that monitor sleep. Mm-hmm. One is the Zio, of course, and the question is, how accurate is a Zio? And then a related question, is there any way to increase REM sleep?
So Zio has had some validation studies comparing it to the sort of the scientific gold standard of physiological monitoring. And I think we don't fully understand yet its validity. Some of the evidence seems to say that it's not particularly bad at defining whether you're in REM sleep and whether you're in non-REM. These devices don't have the accuracy of sort of discriminating between all of those different subtypes of non-REM sleep. For that, you need scientific tools and the detailed physiology. So they're getting increasingly better, is my suspicion. There's a little bit of a danger in that because I think, you know, we're often competitive in industrialized nations, and people are also can be sometimes a little bit obsessive, and I'm one of them. I'm probably sort of like the Woody Allen neurotic of the sleep world, and, you know, thinking about my own sleep. So I think sometimes when I speak to people who use these devices, they get quite competitive when they're not at 99% sleep efficiency, and that gives them anxiety, and that starts to create problems, and it's this downward spiral. So it's sometimes the best evidence is take off the device, get your alarm clock, turn it 180 degrees so you're not clock watching, just relax and have some sleep. And then the second question was, you know, how do we get more REM sleep? I think it's dangerous to try and start to manipulate your own sleep, thinking that you know the Da Vinci code of what type of sleep your brain ultimately needs. Turns out millions of years of evolution has developed mechanisms within your brain and your body, to signal and develop exactly what type of sleep that you need from one night to the next. And so I think the best advice is just let it happen naturalistically and let evolution do what it's very well designed to do.
There are questions about what to do if your body only allows you to have 4 or 5 hours of sleep at a time. And I remember reading, I don't know if this is true, but we often, this is before the light bulb, we'd wake up in the middle of the night and get stuff done and then go back to sleep. Any advice? Are we designed to sleep through the night? And if we don't, what do you do?
So it's a very good question. There's some argument that evidence that we would sort of sleep for half the night, get up, walk around, there is some reasonable evidence for that. Ultimately, I don't think that's naturalistically how you were designed to sleep or how we were designed to sleep as a species. However, it's possible that we were designed to sleep in what's called a biphasic manner. So most of us right now sleep in what we call a monophasic manner, which is that we have one single bout of sleep during the night. If you look at some cultures that are not touched by electricity, they will often sleep biphasically, where they will have 6.5 hours, 7 hours of sleep a night, and then they will have that siesta-like behavior in the afternoon where they'll take an hour nap. And as I said, siesta, it's very common in the Mediterranean regions too. So there may be argument that we should be actually sleeping in two phases, and it coincides with what perhaps many of you will have in the post-lunchtime phase of life, which is that sort of, you know, dip in your alertness. If you're in meetings, it's a dead giveaway. You start to get these head-bobbing notions. And it's not that people are listening to good music. It's that they're giving way to this. And you can see it physiologically. It's this drop in physiological alertness and arousal, which again argues that perhaps that's normally a time when we should be asleep.
How did you get interested in this work? A lot of questions as to the genesis of your research.
Yeah, so I don't think anyone really ever has the ambition, you know, as a young child, to be a sleep researcher. You know, nobody ever wakes up and says, when I get older, I'm going to be asleep. You know, people want to be doctors, firemen, astronauts. No, And so I think most sleep researchers are accidental sleep researchers, and I was certainly one of those too. I was studying for my PhD. I was looking at brainwave patterns in dementia and seeing if we could differentially diagnose different types of dementia and seeing if those changes in brainwave activity were related to the mental impairments. And we were having miserable luck. We were finding no differences, as is common in most people's PhD work. And then I realized, well, perhaps we're looking at the wrong brain state. Maybe we should be looking at sleep rather than wake brainwave activity. And so I started to get very interested in sleep, and we found some good evidence there. And then I realized, okay, now I don't understand what the consequence of these different patterns of sleep actually could be. And I started to read a lot about sleep and realized that we still didn't understand why we sleep. So I thought, well, that's great. I'll go and do a postdoctoral position for 2 years. I'll go and figure out why we sleep, and then I'll come back to this question. Not realizing that for hundreds of years, wonderfully smart people had tried to figure out this question, and they had failed. You know, and I was going to come along in, you know, 2 years and crack the nut. And that was 16 years ago. So I'm still trying to figure out why we sleep. And at some point, I'll probably get back to the dementia and aging thing.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point where we need to wrap things up with one last question. A lot of great questions here tonight, and thank you very much. And that question is, how much sleep do you get?
I used to have the trite answer that I would get 8 hours of sleep whenever I can, which would be never. But I, in all honesty, and it's hokey as it may sound, I do practice what I preach, and I will routinely get about 7.5 to 8 hours of sleep. If I get less than 7 hours of sleep, I can very clearly observe the impairments. I'm routinely dysfunctional, more dysfunctional, I should say, than I normally am, and inefficient. So I do practice what I preach.
Thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Dr. Matt Walker. He's director and principal investigator of Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab at UC Berkeley, and to the audience here in Palo Alto, and all of you who are joining us here on the radio.
Thank you.
Now, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.